All right. Merry Christmas, 14D. If I'm not mistaken, that's also a bra size, isn't it? Or... Now, my home group is in 14C, so I guess... And I'm glad I'm not from Savannah. That's 1A. So now that I've gotten past the spiritual part of the talk, my name is Damon, and I am an alcoholic. Sharon, thank you for being invited. And I want to tell you what, thank you all for who prepared the food. And I tell you what, I got three loves when it comes to food, and that's deviled eggs, green beans, and stuffing. And I got some of different flavors of each one. And so, man, I am feeling very well blessed. I say I'm an alcoholic, and what that means for me is alcohol is not my problem. See, if alcohol was my problem, I could quit drinking. Sort of like a guy that says, just don't drink and go to meetings. And Charlie Yao is no longer with us. Shared right after that guy, and he said, that's like telling a homeless guy just to go buy a house. You know, there's only so much I can do by just not drinking and going to meetings, because what underlies this thing is whatever makes me restless, irritable, and discontent. And, you know, for me, I'll get to a little bit of my story. I think it's important to qualify. I was born in 1955 at Georgia Baptist Hospital, one of the area natives here in that sense. And I have two older sisters. And, you know, our family got along great. You know, I'm one of these guys, don't have a lot of excuses there. We lived down in East Point. When I was 6 years old, I had a pull your pants down club with a girl down the street, and we were the only two members. A lot of my story has to do with pleasure by sneaking around. Did anybody try and get pleasure by sneaking around? Yeah, you know, if I could get away with it, that was just half the fun of it, you know. And that's when I was 6 years old. At 8 years old, I sniffed glue. At 10, my sister turned me on to marijuana as a step up. And this is all in the suburbs, you know. But at 12, my mom was going to be out for the day, so I, ringleader, decided to get the Sprite bottle and a Coke bottle, and we put the clear stuff in the Sprite bottle and the color stuff in the Coke bottle, getting a little bit from all the parents' liquor cabinets, and then went out in the woods and made sure we drank it all so we didn't get in trouble. Of course, we all got sick. I can still remember us walking down and staggering down Terrell Mill Road, you know, and just this troop of, you know, 12-year-olds, you know, staggering down Terrell Mill Road. Anyway, but the next, you know, my sister came home first and found us and then told Mom I had the flu. And I got the day off from school the next day, you know. Yeah, I don't know. Did anybody not have any fun drinking? Because let me tell you what, that would be a sad story. You know, you wind up in AA and you didn't have any fun drinking, you know. But it started out, you know, it's the history of it so much of the time is, you know, fun and then fun with consequences and nothing but consequences. I got a little bit of a different, for me, this is what happened. I was a child of the 60s. Any other child of the 60s, you know? Yeah, there we go. They say if you remember it, you weren't there. But I grew up, and I also was one of those who said, they told me I had a lot of potential if I only applied myself. Any other identification out there, you know? And third grade, we moved up to Marietta from East Point, and the little elementary school I was going to, they paddled them back then. And I still think it's a kind of sickness, they decorated the paddle. I mean, I don't know, it's just, you know, I still remember that. And I got it a couple of times, and they took me to a child psychologist and said I was bored, you know. I recently found an interesting question. What's the difference between boredom and serenity? It's a very interesting question. I used to ask my daughter that back when I was drinking. You know, I thought it was a cute question. Later on, after I got sober and she was 15, she said she was bored at school or something. I said, what's the difference between boredom and serenity? And she said, I got an answer to that now, Dad. I said, oh, what's that? She said, serenity is planned boredom. I don't know that it enlightens me all that much, but it tells me a lot about the 15-year-old mind. But anyway, we did a lot of things growing up. Now, when I went down to this, when they told me I was, they told them I was bored, my parents really went above and beyond. They really couldn't afford to, but they sent me to private school, Pace Academy, down on West Paces Ferry Road. And I was kind of I was living in Marietta back when there was horses across the way from us off Terrell Mill Road. And so I was considered kind of the hit guy. And also I was kind of a goofy kid. Anybody here not respond well to social situations? Anybody else have some identification there? It was funny because I was kind of the brunt there and bullied at that school. And yet back in my neighborhood, I was one of the first houses in that neighborhood, and I was the ringleader. I mean, we had a three-story tree hut. We even had a spinner built in on the third floor. We never used it for what it was intended, but it gave us a sense of hope. I think it's a lot like coming into AA. We'll give you a sense of hope, We were doing all the stuff there, but alcohol was always around during it. But I quit smoking weed probably 70, 71, something like that, and the circle disappeared except for just a couple of people. It turns out they were just acquaintances. But also at this time, I was around one of the hippies, one of the definite hippie, David Perkins. David was a guy who made candles down off the park, in Piedmont Park, and we'd sell them. I'd help him make the candles, and you'd dip them, and kind of twirl them and do all of that. And, Beatles' White Album in the background, a little Jimi Hendrix while we're doing it, But David was a spiritual seeker. But he said something interesting to me. I was kind of doing a lot of work with the Lutheran church and, just to get involved in stuff my parents had me doing. And he said, is it a coincidence you're a Christian in a Christian country? If it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? That got me thinking, if I'd have been born in Saudi Arabia, I'd be Islam, right? If I was born in India, I'd be Hindu or Sikh or Muslim or Buddhist or something. I think a lot of the people who come into AA and stay are fellow seekers, we're seeking, and we've been seeking for a long time. I was sitting up on top of Kennesaw Mountain. I was probably 16 or so, and I was trying to imagine the curve of the earth. Have you ever done that? Just sort of imagine how big this thing really is. And I wanted to know what was on the other side. And so I just started getting an interest in India and China. And my parents ran away from home when I was 17 and moved to Alabama. Might have had something to do with all that stuff I'd been doing. But they'd always wanted to live on a lake, and they designed the house. And actually, they had a room for me down there. But this was Dadeville, Alabama, which was 2,000 people, And I'd been hitchhiking down to Atlanta for years. And so I got the bright idea. I had actually gotten a full-time job with my favorite title of all times, which is a chief inserter at an insurance company. But I was inserting mail into envelopes. Some of you have dirty minds, I think. I was running a Phillipsburg 6-station inserting machine. And I always enjoyed a little bit of the technical stuff. And I just enjoyed getting into a lot of different things. Always have. But I got to delivering the mail around at times and seeing these people in the different offices. And I said, it wouldn't be such a bad idea to get a college education. And moved back down to Alabama. Now, one trip down there, we actually, I took a couple of buddies down to stay down the lake, and we got arrested in Chambers County, Alabama, for going to the bathroom on the side of the road at midnight. There was no other place to go to the bathroom, but the guy driving put his beer can on top of the car, which is sort of like an attraction rather than promotion. And the only car to come by was an unmarked car, and the guy put this big old handgun over, pointing at us, and we're standing over next to the barbed wire fence, and he says, "Come put your hands on the car." And I'm like, "What? I don't know, deliverance? I don't know where." And it turns out that was the sheriff. He was going into work, I really didn't have very many consequences. I wasn't driving, but the guy in the back seat, when he got out, he emptied his pockets and found out he had the wrong pair of jeans on, and a gram of hash came out. And the guy driving, that was a surprise. The guy who was driving, he got, you know, the DUI thing. But I got a poem out of it. I said, "Last night I spent my time in Chambers County Jail with the gray bars of freezing steel and the busted radio whose poor unguarded fate it was to waste away in jail." And yet I think it funny that what occupied my time was laughter and an endless game of cards. I was in there with two guys in for armed robbery, you know, and murder. Another guy in for grand larceny and auto theft. And I just had a good time. But I went to the junior college in Alabama because my grades wouldn't let me into Auburn. It was Alexander City State Community Junior College, and I called it ACSCJCLMNOP. I applied myself. I got 4 O's there. You know, the having a college prep, you know, beforehand really helped out. My parents, who are always, you know, into learning, and I don't know. You know, I'll tell you this today. One of the things I realized is I didn't create me. You know, one of the greatest gifts I can say is everything that I am is a gift. I didn't pick my parents. I didn't pick my DNA. You know, I'd say, how many ancestors do you have? You know. How much choice did I have over those? You know, I somehow have a gift of putting concepts together that other people don't see. I'm also tall. You know, somehow I've got a crazy willingness to do this program, and I can't give you a thimbleful of it. I can't. I can demonstrate it. I can do that, but I've tried to give it away, and I can't. You know, I just feel like a man most richly blessed. I did well enough. My parents said you can go pretty much anywhere. I called up the long distance operator in Colorado because I was looking for higher education, literally. I'd love the mountains. And so I wanted to go up there, call them up, and they said, "What schools do you have there?" And they said, "Colorado and Colorado State." And I said, "No, no, no." And I pulled a penny out of my pocket and flipped it, and it was Colorado State. Some amazing things have come from that flipping of a coin. You know, I don't know that it's necessarily luck, you know. There might have been something going on right then. I went up there, and in the first week, they had at the dorm and during the summer, we're staying there, and went down and they had a party, a little thing for giving away the refrigerators, these little refrigerators, and I got down and sat on a couch next to two gals, and I butted into the conversation. I'm sure you guys will find that hard to believe. But anyway, we're now married 36 years as of October, so... And that's my wife, Sarah. I like the guy who said we never decided to divorce each other at the same time. I think the other thing that happened with us is we decided, and early on before going in, we just said divorce is no option. And I think she's a stubborn woman, too. She just did not want to admit during all my trials and tribulations that she had made a mistake. But I still am a man most richly blessed today. And I didn't realize that for the longest time. So got up there, and I was taking Chinese history and philosophy and went and met her cancer surgeon dad and came down riding a Honda 125 motorcycle with a long hair, and he goes, "What are you going to do with that?" And I said, "Well, I've always considered myself to be a Renaissance man." "What the hell is that?" And I said, "Well, you know, back in the Renaissance, if you studied ants for a few months, you could, you know, write a book about it. You're the world's expert on ants, and then cannonballs flying, or more art, or music, or something." And I really turned out that's what I do my living right now. I found out there's a lot of specialists, but there's very few good generalists, you know, with something in a lot of different areas. And I've sort of made my career that way. My wife was doing occupational therapy classes, and then she went away to Baylor to do her internship, and I decided to take a year off because because I really wanted to go to China. That's really where I wanted to go. I wanted to see that side of the world. Even took a year of Chinese language, and she really didn't want to go. And what I wound up doing is something that was a pivotal point. There's a lot of turning points in our lives, and I started working at a nursing home. And became an orderly, and I worked there for a year. And I got really fascinated with people looking back on 105 years of life, 75 years of marriage. And I found out that it wasn't what they did, but how they did whatever they did that was important. You know, how they did it. Today I understand, for me, I'm now a retired atheist, by the way. I came in as an atheist into the rooms. But I retired because it became too much work to explain everything away that was going on in my life, and I got too damn old for it. That's a very good time to retire. But I realized today that God's will for me isn't a what in terms of me, you know. This is just, believe me, just the world according to Damon right now. But this is, for me, this works. God's will for me is a how. Whatever I do, if I can do it with kindness and integrity, the results will always be favorable. Now I get out, I don't have to worry about the outcome because, you know, I don't care if things don't work out the way I planned as long as the results are beyond my wildest dreams. Would you be okay with that? You know, this is about my, I woke up the other morning. I don't know if you've got, it's, I call it an original thought. It's that thought in the morning where it's not preceded by any other thought. And the thought was this: your belief is much smaller than your faith. And that was a very comforting thing because it used to believe. You see, the reason I became an atheist is I tried to find God in my understanding. Turns out there is not a single logical argument for God that holds up to deep scrutiny. None of them do. If God's all-powerful, can he create a rock so heavy he can't lift it? I mean, you just wind up with these nonsensical little things. And so I thought, well, I can't understand God, therefore there isn't one. Which gave me a lot of trouble coming into the rooms, as you can imagine. Well, anyway, at first I broke up with my wife about not going, and then I decided I wanted her to be the mother of my children. That has been a great decision. She is a fantastic. We've got a 4-year-old grandson, and they're at home right now. We just went to the library because those two will consume about 20 books every 2 nights. I mean, they're reading machines, and she's just phenomenal with him. So anyway, we got married in 1979 and came back here to Atlanta. And I wanted to stay out there, but she loved that things grew out here. My wife collects species. I think I'm the first one she collected. We have goats. We've got an alpaca. We've had chickens until I looked at her the other day. I said, hey, you seen the chickens? And no, we found a bunch of feathers, so we're going to have to replace the chickens. There are other animals out there that think chicken tastes pretty good too. But anyway, we've got a guinea pig. We've had geese and turkeys and just about everything out there. So I come back to Atlanta and I finish up my undergraduate degree, which, by the way, they went and said, when I finished up my undergraduate degree in history, they said, we have a problem. I said, what's that? They said, we can't test you in Chinese. I didn't say anything, but that was very good. It had been 2.5 years since I had it. So I don't know. I just was silent. And I said, well, yeah, you do have a problem. And she said, no, wait a minute. You've had Fortran. And I had some pre-courses for a business. I was going to go into international business. And it turns out when I took Fortran and BASIC, which are programming languages, they click just like that. It turns out that conceptually, programming is very much like history. It's the history of stuff as it moves through a computer. And it's concepts and everything like that. And it just, you know, I found it very easy to do. And so I said, that's a computer language. And she said, yeah, but it's spoken all over the world. So my undergraduate degree is in history with a specialty in India and China. And my foreign language is Fortran. But I got involved in the American Marketing Association down there and wound up doing some things, and next thing you know, I'm working with the marketing department, and the next thing you know, I've got a job working for Equifax. And I worked there for 12 years. And during that time, and we got a lot of great home movies and everything, I did not drink alcoholically during the 80s. In fact, one who, when I'd had a couple of drinks and I started to feel it, I get that, I would stop. It wasn't even a thought, I wasn't even thinking about it. But what happened is I began to climb up the corporate ladder, and I realized the lady who collected species wasn't exactly the kind of person who would be a corporate executive. You know, so I, all of a sudden, in The Varieties of Religious Experience, which is the book that Abby gave to Bill Wilson in December of 1934, right, I mean like the day after he had his hot flash, in there, William James is talking about what are the psychological traits of someone who has had a spiritual awakening, not what the dogma is of the religion or anything, but what had happened. And there were two things. One was We don't find God in the mountaintops. We find God in the valleys. And the other one was that there is a shift from pessimism to optimism. And I was one who went the other way. I started looking at what was wrong with my wife, what was wrong with my life, what was wrong with the world. And then one of the guys that worked for me had a bachelor party, and we went to a belly dancing thing, and then we went to a strip joint down on Cheshire Bridge. Now, there's a pull your pants down club. And I started thinking, you know, well, I'm not getting this at home, you know. And I've got my my son was born in 84, my daughter in 89, and I left work and went to late one night, and we just went by to get a massage, and it turned out the gal offered the whole treatment, and I took it. And I justified myself by saying in China and Japan they have concubines. They relieve the sexual pressure off of the wife. A couple of problems with that. Anybody here ever suffer from delusion? Okay. There's a difference between denial and delusion. Denial is knowing the truth and being unwilling to tell it for fear of the negative consequences. And delusion is believing something that's simply not true. I mean, it's building castles in the air and moving into them. And, you know, my wife's not Chinese or Japanese. I'm not in China or Japan, you know. But I'll tell you what, Mama raised me better than that. I am today very, very grateful that I have the ability to feel guilty. You know, I think there are those out there that don't have that. There's an inner compass in me that the more I acted out, the more that tension built up. And in so many ways, when I crossed a line in that drinking, I would drink, I'd go to the strip joints and drink there, and then in the mornings I'd have to take a drink because I drank a little bit too much, and I crossed the line. And the thing that makes me different from my fellows, truly different, they're really, I don't know, there's any, and Dr. Silkworth has a great talk on saying, the alcoholic mind, what are you talking about? That's like saying a diabetic mind. You know, the person who continues to eat sugar and not do their insulin, they got a diabetic. Or what about the guy with the heart problem who continues to go out and run and jump and lift and carry when he knows he shouldn't? Does he have a heart attack mind? I think the thing that makes me different from my fellows is what alcohol does for me. Not what it does to me, but what it did is it made me feel all right with who I was right now. It gave me peace. I'm going to go on that theme tonight. I want to talk about peace. I want to talk about going from a state where I did not have it to where it is a central theme in my life today. And I think it also goes very well with the season, does it not? So I wound up getting a job while some of this was starting to go on. I wound up getting a great job with Hewlett-Packard, and I was flown around the country, went down to Sao Paulo, Brazil. I was helping them build out data centers, all of this stuff. But in the meantime, the drinking starts escalating. I'm going out. I'm on a 24/7. We're doing outsourcing, so I'm running a data center. It's 24/7. So I can make an excuse anytime to be there or not be there. And I can work enough hours, but in between times, I'm going and sitting in a parking lot and drinking by myself. I started to cut every thread connecting me to the rest of the world. And in April of 2001, they got a report that somebody smelled that alcohol in my breath around their $1 million worth of equipment. And I, of course, this time I denied it. I knew the truth, but I was in flat denial. And I said, not me. It must be some medication I'm on or something. And I quit, though. And I put on the afterburners. Anybody do that? You know, we start getting the accolades at work. Things start coming together. And then the CEO laid off everybody who was on probation. And that was in August of 2001. And I told him, I said, I'm going to be a millionaire when I come back here in a year from now. Today I'm a millionaire many times over in an entirely different currency. You see, I didn't want the stuff. I wanted the way I thought I would feel when I got the stuff. When you got the stuff, did it ever make you feel the way you thought it was going to make you feel? Was it ever enough? So much of this disease, isn't it, is not enough or too much. Okay? Get enough or you got too much. It's always enough. It's never just, I can't be at peace, which means tranquility. Means I'm okay right here, right now, with what I got, with who I am, with the way I was put together, with my history and my story and what I am with you and who you are. I'm over in Birmingham working on a kind of program. I was doing some stuff for youth soccer, trying to build a business up to do that. And my sister comes in and says, "You see this?" And we see the one of the twin towers burning, and then we see the other plane fly into it. And I know enough that I know my industry has just changed. I waited 2 days. I'm still not drinking. They go off to a German club, and I'm sitting there. And does anybody else always notice where the liquor is in the house? You know? And there was a bottle of Black Jack, and it was like, high. you know, I like what Earl Hightower, he talks about, you know, we got a medical problem here, you know, you just got your little tense, you're just a little tense, you've been off it for a long time, you can just take one, you know, and so I had three, and of course, but I get pleasure by sneaking around, so I'm not going to drink the whole bottle. Guess where I am at 9 o'clock the next morning? You guys know, I'm in the parking lot. And guess what? It doesn't open until 9:30. I'm standing up here today because I never want to be the guy sitting on the parking lot at 9 o'clock in the morning waiting for the liquor store to open. King alcohol was ruling me, and that was after not drinking from April until September. So I went through a series where I would stop drinking, and I'd dust myself off, and I'd start putting on the burners, and sometimes weeks, sometimes a couple months, I'd start feeling a little bit irritable, a little bit restless, a little bit discontent, just like a pressure cooker, you know. And then I would change my mind about not drinking. Bill talks about on page 60, he says this neat word, convinced. He says it twice. Bill doesn't use the same word twice unless he really thinks it's about the one word that fits it. And that is getting convinced and staying convinced that when I take a drink, I become a different person, and I have no way of telling what that guy is going to do. And I could tell you how much you're going to drink. So I go in this roller coaster thing, and it gets to September of 2003, and I quit drinking until Thanksgiving. And I'm over in Birmingham with my sister and my family, and we get along great and everything, but the restless irritable, and I go in, I tell them I got a client to call, I got an emergency, don't have a client. I go get $300 out of the ATM we can't afford, and I drive all the way from Birmingham to Atlanta going, don't think about what you're doing, don't think, la 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 la, don't think about what you're doing, this doesn't make, don't. And I went to Mardi Gras and went to a massage thing in Cheshire Bridge, and 4 or 5 days later I had 105 degree temperature and I was in real bad shape. And when it broke, something very strange started happening, and I started passing gas and debris when I urinated. This is in December. And in February I went to the doctor. Anybody else sort of wish stuff away, just wishing it away? Now, I was drinking all the time now, so I had to drink just to drive down there, and I was suffering from a lot of anxiety attacks. The idea that I would ever be standing up here talking to you guys about what I'm talking about was insane. That I could just tell you guys what it was like and just tell you this, the facts, you know, and do that, because I was cutting every thread, because you guys are way too difficult to manage and deal with. You know, I was drinking a fifth of vodka a day. I'd isolated in my house. I didn't want to answer the phone. I was really becoming... Did anybody see Never Ending Story? You remember that old movie? And in Never Ending Story, there's the nothing. And they say, well, what is the nothing? And he said, well, if it was something, it would be something. And that's what I was in the house. You know, my son had already left, and my daughter is, you know, 12, 13 years old at this time, you know, in formative years, and I can't even write her excuse notes. My hands are shaking so much. She writes them and I sign them, and she goes, Daddy, what's wrong with your signature? I went to that doctor. Now, I like this guy who said we should go to veterinarians because they're used to treating patients who won't tell them what's going on. And it was okay that I'd be found with a sexually transmitted disease with 25 years married, but don't take away my alcohol. Don't find out that I can't drive without drinking. Because see, alcohol solution, it wasn't my problem, right? My wife got me to go again in May, and I finally told the doctor then. Very interesting. I saw him in an Al-Anon meeting, come out of an Al-Anon meeting, And I got a chance to help him with his son later on. This is one of those kind folks that are in healthcare that we are so blessed to have in your lives. I know some of you, I see you nodding because I've been there for you too. Whenever we have one of the nurses or those folks come into the meetings, I make special effort to try and get attention to them because they're going to touch a whole lot of lives. You know, and I want them to understand that they can't do anything except get them to us. Tell them about us, right? Because they're powerless over this stuff. Well, in July, my wife gave me one of those letters that said, we're going to maybe lose the house if we do. You're not maybe invited. And so on August the 9th of 2004, I had my last drink. I call my sobriety date August the 10th. It was my first full day. And I kicked on my own, but the same old plan for 2.5 days. And on August the 12th at 3:00 in the morning, I had my 1 hour of sleep. Anybody been there? You know? By the way, during this time, I'd been smoking cigarettes for 8 to 10 years, and my wife didn't know it. I would hang out the bathroom window smoking cigarettes. Here I was, just like the kid used to sneak out, you know, and go wander around. And here I am. You know, a great question for an alcoholic is, what would a grown-up do? You know, let's pretend. Something happened, and I fully conceded to my innermost self without knowing anything about AA, and I said the three-word prayer of an atheist, and I said, I need help. And I said it to the depths of my soul. And I knew something had happened. I said, this is almost like some TV show or something. You know, to this day, I have not had the obsession to drink since that moment. I know this, if I hadn't come in and stayed in AA, that same old thing about restless and irritable and discontent would come about. I told my wife I'd made an appointment to go to behavioral services, and I had not made the appointment. And all of a sudden, now I've got a decision. Do I lie? And I said, I'm tired of lying. Anybody else get there? I was tired of lying. It was like keeping all these plates spinning. You know, it's a lot of work. So I went down and woke her up. She's sleeping on the couch. I got my daughter off, and I told her, I've been a son of a bitch. That's just the words I used. And I told her and outlined briefly what I had been doing. I said, do you want to know any more? She said, no. I didn't tell her about the smoking cigarettes. I still had 4 cigarettes left. But I told her the next Tuesday, and I quit that day, though. That Thursday was the last cigarette that I've had to smoke because it was the same deal. It was all lying. You know, that's what it was. It was lying. And I called behavioral services, and they said, well, we can have somebody see you August 31st. I said, I don't think you understand. I'm drinking a fifth of vodka a day. And they said, we'll get back to you. And I went down, went to the behavioral services the next week, went to the doctor. He started working on it. What it turned out I had is I had diverticulitis, fistulas. And what that means is there were cracks between the colon and the bladder, and they were stuck together. There's only one thing that confused the doctors. I was not dead. That is just like a belly wound, you know, when a gunshot wound. Somehow they sealed up, and they sealed up perfectly, where no bugs, you know how small bacteria are? None of them got in there. And it took them a while to go ahead and decide to do the surgery because they said, we're going to have to just go in and look. And it turns out they found 3 of them. I had about that much of my, about a foot and a half of my colon taken out. And you know what? AA showed up there at the hospital. And I also had them do an epidural, so I didn't have anything from the neck up. And because I don't want to play around with this thing. You know, I also don't, when I go to a restaurant, I don't eat anything that's been cooked with alcohol. I don't want to play around with this thing. I've been there. I don't ever want to go back. I get over to the psychiatrist. I tell her everything. By the way, they gave me 14 pages of forms to fill out, and I had a fear of filling out forms, and I just started, okay, and I just started filling out, and my hands were shaking, and it took me maybe 45 minutes or so to fill those out, and by the end, I'm going, you know, just right along. And she said, anything else to me about, you know, I said, well, I used to have a fear of filling out forms, but you guys cured that in one sitting, so... And then they sent me over to behavioral services at Abernathy, and I met this fellow Joe Pringle, and Joe had these Buddhist books and stuff up on his wall, and he said anything else? Well, I said I have a little problem with the God thing, and he said, well, you know, you were reading that book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I was reading that while I was drinking, by the way. And I was anything but highly effective. But there is something in there, and he talks about living a principle-centered life, and also that these things are like natural laws. And I said, you mean like gravity? He said, yeah. He says, why don't you consider these things like gravity? You know, today I still do. These principles are that fundamental. And when I rely on them, just like I'm relying on gravity as I stand up here, I find out, and I don't need to understand gravity, do I? I just need to, if I jump out of the plane, you pull the ripcord, it is suggested, you know, that I begin to rely on it. And what happened was I wound up going to the first meeting that Friday. I didn't want to go to AA, but they had it on the deal. And I went through a lot of syllabuses. I went through college. Okay. And I go, and that night before, I had my first night's sleep, full night's sleep. You know, it should be in the promises. I think that and a good solid bowel movement should be in the promises. I don't know if anybody else had that happen. Our bodies do not behave very well under alcohol. I see some nodding heads out there. I'm not the only one. But anyway, I looked, and I couldn't find a meeting in Cobb County. I went to three different ones before I found a meeting. In fact, I bought my big book at Barnes & Noble. You know, they're gone. I still got the big book, but paid retail for it. But the first meeting I went to, the first guy to raise his hand to his right, I needed a sponsor too, and I asked him to sponsor me, and he hauled dirt for a living. And I was the one that built data centers, and he got out in the parking lot. He said, you believe in God? I said, nope. He said, how about a power greater than yourself? I said, I don't think so. He said, let me get this straight. You're the most powerful thing in the universe? I had to think about that. I said, well, probably not. He said, well, at least there's some hope. He said, I only know one way to do this, and that's to take you by the book. Thank God. You know? And he took me through the book. On January 1st, midnight, I burned my fourth step as part of the fireworks at the Howe Place. The next November, he calls me up. He says, I'm having a heart attack. Don't need to come down here. The ambulance is coming. Don't worry about coming to the hospital because my family's coming down there. But you know that guy you're working with? You know, maybe you need to try this and this and this. I'm like, man, this guy's on the ball, you know? I mean, here he is. And so I tell my son, he happens to be at the house, just happened to be stopped in. And my son goes back to his apartment, and his roommate comes out and says, I got to go to the hospital. My dad just had a heart attack. What's his name? Steve Davis. My son and his son had been roommates. Not just friends or acquaintances, roommates. I don't have time enough to tell you all of the different things like that that has happened to me since I did take a suggestion. And in that first year I took a suggestion, and it was, act as if there is a God. Act as if. Regardless of what I believe, act as if, and amazing things happen. And he died on December the 16th of 2005. And I'm driving along, and I'm going, I lost my sponsor. And I heard his voice come in my head saying, oh, I get it. It's all about you. So I started calling his family and everything, you know. And when I first got sober in 2004, I answered a little ad in a thing called the Bright News Newspaper, and it was about non-medical home health care at home, and I started doing that. I took care of an elderly couple from 2004 till 2010, and I got to have the last lucid conversation on earth with a man at 94 years old. And I heard him talking about being a deacon in Fair Oaks, and a lady came off the street homeless with her kids. And they hadn't counted the offering plate, and he took a $20 bill out and gave it to the lady. And one of the other deacons asked him after she'd left, said, Bailey, you think that's right? And Bailey said, I don't think Jesus would mind. You know. And I did that all because I wanted to get away from computers for a little bit. I didn't know that as I was getting out and getting into service. See, what I would do is I'd go over in the morning. I would strip the bed, do that, clean the bathrooms, make lunch for her. After Bailey died, and this was the wife, and then she'd go upstairs and watch her soap opera. By the way, her pastor came by and gave her trouble about watching the soap opera. He didn't think it was very spiritual. And she said, "I'll stop watching the soap opera when you stop shooting little bunny rabbits." So, a hoot. But anyway, and I got to do that. I got to be a caregiver for a guy who flew 116 missions in Lancaster and Wellington bombers. It was with NASA before it was NASA, who knew. He negotiated face-to-face with Howard Hughes. He knew Wernher von Braun. I mean, this guy was like Forrest Gump with a degree in fluid dynamics, and I got to do that in sobriety. I want to talk about real briefly, how much time do I have here? No, just keep going, all right. Well, anyway, I want to talk about this theme about peace and some things that I've found. And let me put this up here. All right, I want to, there's a number of readings. When you first talk about Bill on page 8, he talks about, in reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. This is on that page 8. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Bill uses peace a lot of times. Then he talks about Ebby coming and talking to him, and this is when Bill had his hot flash, as he called it. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, you know, this idea that why don't you choose your own concept of God. But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had ever known, as never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. What I want to share with you, because it's just all through, I've got a copy if anybody, it's a very interesting thing to look at how oftentimes at the very, some of the most core principles in here, being in the presence of God and feeling the peace. Today I move in the presence of something I don't even understand. It's the great reality. You know, the spiritual life is not a theory. It really isn't a theory for me. Everything else, what you guys are, you're largely theoretical to me. I mean, what I think you're thinking of me right now is not what you're thinking of me. You know, what I think you've been through today is not what you've been through, you know. But the spiritual realm that I move in is real. And all the rest of it is opinions. And I want to talk about this because this has everything to do with peace. I love it when we were laughing and reading the 10th tradition. The 10th tradition got me lit up on living the traditions in my life. The fewer opinions I have, the negative ones, about outside issues, the less I get drawn and the less peace there is in my life. I've turned out today that I have one negative opinion, and that's about negative opinions. You know? They don't serve me well. I found out I was working with a guy whose head was very busy. And I thought, let me see if I can narrow this thing down a little bit. Okay, here's what I do on a daily basis. I change the story I'm telling myself about you such that it adds to the quality of the lives of the people around me, not me. I need to stop working on the quality of my life. I do not do well at it. What I need to do is add to the quality of your life. And the more people's lives I add the quality to, I'm surrounded by quality, and I get quality by reflection. I have to learn how to take the... Remember, I went from pessimism to optimism? I am not going back there. I don't care what it is. You know, for me today, it's not that the glass is half full or the glass is half empty. It's that there's such a thing as glass and such a thing as water. Let's think about that. What did it take to have glass? You had to have a star explode. First stars were only hydrogen. You had to have it explode and coalesce into a whole other solar system. Then you had to have two planetoids collide and form the Earth-Moon system. And then all this water started forming, and there's this moon just stirring up the clouds, and it's grinding up the rocks, and all of a sudden you got sand. And then somehow Living, I don't care how it happens, somehow living creatures that are aware can build a fire, look underneath, and they see the fires melting the glass, they see the little guy. You know, the first thing they make out of it? Beads. You know? Probably because they wanted some sex, you know, as you know. But anyway, so now that's that. But then all of a sudden, over thousands of years, people begin to develop with this thing. You know, see what I'm saying? It's not that the glass is half full. It's that there's such a thing as glass. Now, talk about water. You know about the Goldilocks zone? Do you know what that is? The Goldilocks zone is we're in a very strange place where three forms of water can exist on the same planet. You know, liquid, solid, and gas. Do you realize how narrow a range of temperature that is? I like this little Indian yogi. He said, to know reality, you must be astonished. So if I'm getting a negative opinion about this world, that means that even trash on the side of the road is astonishing. And that's, so I want to read what Dr. Bob said and a couple of things and just focus on this idea about peace and then we'll wrap it up. In 1948, Dr. Bob did a talk in Detroit, and this is from a pamphlet that AA's got. By the way, it's slightly inaccurate. I've listened to that talk many times, so it's close, but they did a little editing. But he says, this is Dr. Bob, he says, you know, as far as everybody's ultimate aim is concerned, it doesn't make much difference whether we're drinking or whether we're sober. Either way, we're all after the same thing, and that's happiness. We want peace of mind. The trouble with us alcoholics was this. We demanded that the world give us happiness and peace of mind in just the particular way we wanted to get it. That was by the alcohol route. And he says we weren't overly successful, you know. He said, but when we take time to find out some of the spiritual laws and familiarize ourselves with them and put them into practice, then we do get happiness and peace of mind. I feel extremely fortunate and thankful that our Heavenly Father has let me enjoy them. Anyone can get them who wishes to. Can I say that again? Anyone can get them who wishes to. There seem to be some rules of the game that we must follow, but happiness and peace of mind are always here, open and free to anyone, and that is the message we can give to our fellow alcoholics. You see, ultimately, it's about being at peace. You know, we cease fighting everyone and everything, including alcohol. You know that Bill wanted to change a word in the third step prayer? If you go to As Bill Sees It, page 210, he took the word victory out. Because the first time I read that, I said, that seems out of place. And here's what he says. He says, and this is the prayer I say every morning, and every time I start working with anybody, is, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that my transcendence over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. Now, transcendence might sound like a big word, but it has the same number of syllables as alcohol, so it can't be that big a word. But what it does mean is it means I go from being a bottom feeder, I swim to the surface, I grow wings, and I fly. It means that I go from the guy you just heard to the guy you see here now. From the guy who cut every thread connecting him to the rest of the world, who wants to live by this little ditty. And this is from step 8 in the 12 and 12 on page 77. And this just continues to grow larger and larger in my life. Learning how to live in the greatest peace, partnership, and brotherhood with all men and women of whatever description is a moving and fascinating adventure. When I stop getting to where I'm trying to arrange life to suit myself, to try and manage the outcomes, and what I really want to do is learn how to live in the greatest peace, partnership, and brotherhood with everybody. And you know what? My outcomes are astonishing. My outcomes, the quality of my outcomes has gone way up. When I was thinking about this talk, a song came to mind. I play the guitar, and I have a lot of songs in my head from that. But it's one that has deep meaning for me. I'll try and make it through it. Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me. Let there be peace on earth, the peace that was meant to be. With God as our Father, brothers all are we. Let me walk with my brother in perfect harmony. Let peace begin with me. Let this be the moment now. With every step I take, let this be my solemn vow. To take each moment and live each moment in peace eternally. Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me. Thank you for letting me share.